Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's October 14th, 2011, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long. Guess what, Chris?
I will guess what?
We are not going to tease our listeners anymore. We are finally going to detail part one of our road trip in the main topic today.
I was starting to like it, though. I was starting to enjoy the teasing role.
Yeah, I kind of felt like one of those little 11 o'clock news anchors.
Yeah.
Hey. The president's been shot. But the president of what? Come back after the break and find out.
Now I know what it's like to be all those popular high school girls.
Oh, but yes, in the main topic, we will dig into our road trip and have some fun, tell you about L.A. in part one of what I believe is going to turn into an exhaustive four-part series.
Yeah.
But we'll break it up.
Thank God.
Those travel phobes out there that don't want to hear about it. But
we actually considered doing it all in one show. That would have been a record.
Yeah, that would have been crazy.
Insane.
That would have been in well in excess of our 100th show extravaganza.
That was awesome.
But, I bring that up because the first item we want to talk about today, actually, it was one of the more humorous parts of our trip, I think. We were, traveling all over God's creation. And everywhere we went, I was looking up at the TV, and of course it's sports bars and poker rooms, so ESPN is on all the time, right?
Right.
And they were showing this movie, Catching Hell.
Yeah.
It's the latest and greatest in the ESPN series of their 30 for 30, all about Steve Bartman and that foul ball in Wrigley Field. And it was funny and frustrating for me because the movie was so captivating that I was watching it at everywhere we went with no sound on and no closed captioning.
I know.
And it was captivating as it was, but I'm like, God, I can't wait till I get home and I can actually sit down and watch this thing and actually hear it, right?
Yeah.
So I get home and I DVR it and I watch it this week. And while I'm watching it, I'm also engaged in this little back and forth on our forum at anteupmagazine.com/forum. And I'll call it a back and forth. It's not a fight like you and Rand are having. This was, a civil discussion. And so I'm watching Catching Hell. I'm responding on the forum. And I'm like, you know what? I think there's a parallel here. All right?
Okay.
And I know you're going to think I'm crazy. But
probably.
Then again, I come to expect you thinking I'm crazy.
Yeah, it's doing nothing to change my opinion of you.
All right, well, this Catching Hell thing, it's pure genius, and they do a lot of great things in terms of the filmography. They actually are able to cut out all the fans, so it's just Bartman and Alou going for the ball,
Right.
And then they cut out Bartman to see if Alou would have actually caught it. So they do all that cool stuff. But for me, and this is the case for all movies, I think what I really like is the storytelling. And the storytelling was really, really good in this. And it started out, the first whole half hour, they don't mention anything about Steve Bartman. It's all about Bill Buckner.
Right.
And the ball rolling under his legs. And so then they get into Bartman. And then they end the movie going back to Buckner. And I believe it was 2008, Red Sox break the curse. They got two World Series titles. Now Buckner feels comfortable actually finally coming back into Fenway and gets a rousing reaction from a town that pretty much wanted to kill him for the last 20-some years, right?
Right.
And so the filmmaker makes the point that, wow, is all it takes is for the Sox to win the World Series for them to forget about ball rolling under Buckner's legs. And if that's the case, is it all it's going to take for Chicago to forgive Steve Bartman is for the Cubs to win a World Series?
You know, that's funny, too. You said both things there, forget and forgive. Which is it? Are they? Because I don't think they'll ever forget any of that.
That's right. Forgive. All right. We'll go with forgive.
Okay, we'll go with forgive. I think that Bartman will be off the hook if they win one. But I don't know, maybe.
Okay, well, that's the point that the filmmaker's making, and I think it's intriguing. And so, you know, having this back and forth on the forum about Full Tilt. And, you know, my contention on the show for the last couple weeks is that the Full Tilt name is ruined. All right?
Yeah.
It's circling down the toilet, and no one's ever going to trust it ever again. Now, of course, I was chinking that armor last week when I mentioned that Dennis Phillips said there's players over in Europe just hemming and hauling to get back playing on Full Tilt as long as they get their money back, right?
Right.
And some folks on the forum are saying that, too. You know, hey, look at Kobe Bryant. We like him now. Tiger Woods, we're starting to like him. Michael Vick, he's back playing. We like him now. People, you know, forgive after time. And the point is that if Full Tilt makes good on all the money that they owe players, will players forgive them and just go back to playing on Full Tilt? Is that what it takes to turn the tide? Or is that all it takes, I guess I should say?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that, you know, when you're mentally invested in a team or something, as long as that it's a lot different than money. It does. I mean, it hurts that your team lost because of this Bartman or your team lost because of Buckner, but it doesn't affect your day-to-day life as far as whether or not you're going to put food on the table or whatever. As far as somebody taking money from you and not giving it back, I don't know. I don't think it'll be forgiven. I think they'll be happy they got their money back. They'll be happy about this other guy bought out the company and paid them. And I think some people will go back. And I do believe that America is a country that likes to forgive. I think they like stories like that. But in this case, it's affecting their money. It's not like some guy cheating on his wife, some celebrity, and then they make good or something, and they're like, oh, okay, this is different. This affected their money and their own actual things that they're doing for day-to-day lives. So I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's going to be tough for people to forgive Full Tilt. And on the other hand, you know, Ultimate Bet had this huge scandal, and people still continue to play on there, even though there was cheating involved, and there's no way for you to actually know if the cheating was still going on or not, yet you still played. So, it's an intriguing question. I wouldn't know from my standpoint. I would never forgive if it was proven that a company was stealing from me or never paid me back because they're shoddy, whatever. I don't know if I'd forgive them. The other thing, though, is that, and I'm having a little debate on our forum, too, about the fact that it is what you like to say, the Wild Wild West, and this is something that we had to know could happen, and we, you know, did it anyway, you know, uh-huh. So I don't know. I don't know about forgiven. I know that I would probably seek out every other possible regulated way to play before I would go back to them, you know, in this situation. I mean, just because it's new ownership doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, there aren't still people working for them that were working for them before. There's no way for me to ever know that. So I don't know. I don't think people will forgive them. I really don't.
Hmm. Okay.
If you had, you know, if you had that much money on there and then they gave it back to you, you know, without interest, obviously they're not going to give you with interest, just give you what they think you're owed. But I would say, you know what, you tied up my money for so long because you guys couldn't put together a quality product. I don't forgive you for doing this. Yeah, you got my money back, but it doesn't necessarily make everything right, you know. And then I would move on, I think. But I don't know. How about you?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've already obviously said my piece. I don't think anybody would go back. And like I said, I obviously think I'm wrong because people will. You know, I believe a lot in forgiveness or redemption. You know, I'm having that discussion on the forum as well, too. So, I mean, I guess not to contradict myself, I would have to say sure. People will go back. But I think you hit the point right away. And your answer is that when money's involved, it changes everything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's cheating on your spouse. There's cheating on a test. There's doing something dishonest at work. But when there's money, for whatever reason, that seems to elevate it to a different level.
And
I think you're right. I think it's, to me, that's what would be most surprising is these people that have 10, 15, 20,000 on there, them to say, oh, you know what? Hey, whoo, got my money back. Woo! Thank gosh.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to forget those 9, 12, 24 months, whatever, that I didn't know whether I was going to get that money back. And I'm ready to go. Let's fire up that sit and go. I don't know. It seems odd to me that would happen. But, I mean, I guess it's an academic discussion anyhow, because we're really talking about folks that aren't in the U.S., because I don't think Volt Tilt ever going to be back in the U.S., regardless. So that doesn't really matter too much, I guess, to me. It's going to be more of a world issue than a U.S. issue. You know, players over around the world probably have a different opinion of this whole thing, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's tough because I played recreationally, so my standpoint is a lot different than those who were playing for a living or really counting on that money to earn that money and take it home. And so that's why a lot of the arguments that I'm putting on are when I'm talking about on the forum with people is, you know, I can see why they're so passionate about it, because maybe a lot of them had a lot of money on there or used that as second income or something, and that's where you're totally affected by it. Whereas me, I would only put on what I lose, and I'm a recreational gambler or poker player. And so whatever I lost, I lost. So when I would lose a buy-in or something, then I would say, well, I could afford to lose that. So I'm not vehemently, you know, trying to castrate the owners of Full Tilt. You know, I not that they didn't do anything wrong, because they did.
That's
but, you know what I'm saying?
Because there's two kind of players on Full Tilt. You're right. There's people like us that went into the whole online thing, and not just Full Tilt, but any sites, always thinking, hey, when I put this money online, it may not ever come off.
Right.
I may lose it, or something might happen, and it gets seized or something, and I'm fine with it. And I think there's a whole other group of people that just refuse to believe that. And they put that money on, and they thought it was safe, or it should be safe, and that they were going to win, and those are the people, I think, that have more anger over this situation than I think folks like you and me, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, that makes a difference too, I think. Yeah. You're just your frame of mind on online poker beforehand.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, you know, we're trying to get past this whole Volatil thing. And I know you have a little trepidation with me adding this clip to the show. because Nick from Charlotte, we gave him his piece last week. And then he came back, hey, you guys missed my point. Here's what I meant to say. And to be honest, I think this really kind of sums up the whole issue for me. And I know you're begging to hear my explanation of that. So,
okay.
Let's play the this week's clip from Nick from Charlotte.
So, if I put in $400 to play in a game, and I lose it against somebody who doesn't have a real $400 in there, did I not really lose it because he didn't really wager money against me? I you know, this whole thing is just, it's wrong. It's wrong for Full Tilt not to set these players right. I know they can't, but it was wrong of them to allow them to take so many deposits without actually having the money in there and allowing these players to play.
Okay, here's the thing, Chris. People are mad. He said that right there. I'm just, Full Tilt is wrong.
Yeah.
And we said, Full Tilt's just wrong.
Yeah.
All right. Yes! Yes! Full Tilt is wrong! When the Department of Justice said, hey, go ahead and pay your players back, and they said, oopsie, we don't have the money, they're wrong! All right? There's no debate about that. And I understand it, and this is what it kind of hit me when I heard this clip and I thought about it a little bit, where I think I aired, or maybe we aired on the show, is that we went through that period of anger personally ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And we got on the show, we had moved past it, and we're trying to talk about, well, where do we go from here? And I think a lot of our listeners and people otherwise aren't ready to make that next leap. They're still angry. They're still mad at Full Tilt, and they just want to scream and yell and throw things at the wall until they feel better about it. All right, and that's fine. That's fine. You know, if it takes you 2 or 3 weeks or 7 or 8 years of smashing stuff before you can calm down and think about this issue rationally, that's fine. I get it. But I guess my point is that you do that, nothing good comes from that other than just relieving your stress, right?
Right.
You stub your toe, you scream, F-bomb. It doesn't make the toe hurt any less, right?
Right.
It just calms you down a little bit. So, yes, absolutely. We all need to go through those steps before we can move on. So I was thinking of it this way. You know, hey, if you've been trying to get tickets to Justin Bieber forever, all right, you get the tickets and you're getting the car and you're driving to the concert and you blow a flat tire. All right, you get out, of course you're going to yell and scream and drop F-bombs. You're going to kick the tire. You're going to throw your 72-ounce big gulp and throw the median. Ah! Why is this happening to me? All right? That's great, but that's not going to get you to the Justin Bieber concert, right, Chris? At some point, after you rant and rave, you're going to have to get down on the ground, jack the car up, and put the tire on and move on. And I think that's what we were trying to get at, and I'm hoping people understand now, is be as mad as you want. We're mad, too. But being mad doesn't solve the problem. Solving the problem, and what I need people now to do, I think, is get down on the ground with me and jack the car up, put the tire on, and let's move forward on what we can do, and that is to fight this U.S. attorney that is trying to steal a PR campaign from us and threaten online poker in general. And the longer we stay mad and yell and scream and throw things, the more success he's going to have in keeping us from ever playing again. So I guess I apologize to our fans for not just screaming in rage at some point to let you know that I was just as mad as you were, but I just assumed that we had all moved on from that point and we're on the same bus and headed to the Justin Bieber concert to get online poker. And maybe we just forgot that.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is that it was just because it was revisited with these four guys. Those are all new allegations. So, yeah, we were upset a long time ago on Black Friday and all that stuff. But now that you find out there's four individuals that we thought we trusted had something to do with this, possibly, that's what reignited all their fury. And so it's understandable. And I see what you're saying, too. So you're both right. They're upset, and they want – and they look to us sometimes for certain things. Most of the time it's just entertainment and for us to flub the hand of the week. But, you know, they also, some of them look for us to be that beacon or whatever. And in this instance, we were trying to be balanced, which we still are. And we're trying to move on and trying to say, hey, look, there's the other side of the equation. There's a U.S. attorney who's abusing his power by using certain terms that he shouldn't be throwing around. And we do still live by the edict that everyone is innocent until proven guilty. So we need to remember the balance of journalism and the balance of American life and see if we can get that, you know, rectified too. But yeah, exactly like you said, you know, the U.S. attorney is not playing fair here, and he's trying to squash everything we're trying to accomplish by getting online regulated and legal in America. So yeah, you're right. I understand what you're saying, and yeah, you're right. It's just... yeah, I just want to move on. This is like three straight weeks of full tilt, and doesn't deserve it. They don't deserve any of this. You know what I mean? It's crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, good. As long as people know that we were upset, man, and that you should be mad.
There is no one listening to this show who lost more money than we did by Black Friday and full tilt going under. Believe me.
That's probably a fair point.
Believe me. So, I mean, there's just no one. And so, believe me when I say that we were wondering if the company was going to go under when that happened. So we're still here. We're still fighting. We're doing what we can to survive. You guys need to too. And if you want online poker to survive, then you need to fight.
Excellent. Put your gloves on, Rocky. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, don't use too much of that music. We're going to get copyright issues here.
Yeah, less than 15 seconds. We're all right. I'm going to let the little listeners fight the full tilt war right now. I am moving my troops into strategic positions to battle buying in short.
I can't wait to talk to you about this because I don't understand the alternative. So let's just get into this and see what happens.
All right. Now, this is something that's different in every poker room and every jurisdiction. All right. So I would think in probably most places, their regulations on buying in short are acceptable to me. I'm not trying to ban the whole concept. What I'm trying to do is ban the ridiculousness part of the concept. Actually, I'm trying to ban ridiculous part of all concepts, but that's a much bigger issue that I don't have troops for. But here's the thing. You know, when we were out on this California trip, I was playing one day, and there was a guy at the table that rebought in, I would say, at least 12 times.
Jeez.
All right. And for amounts as little as $15 at a 4/8 Omaha 8 game with a full kill. All right, $15, think about that. If it's a full kill on, he doesn't even have enough money that he just bought in for to play this game to call a preflop raise properly.
Right.
All right? And if it's not a kill, he can't even make it to the end of the hand with one bet. All
right? Right.
That is ridiculous to me. Because all it does is slow down the game. It lets this guy, you know, uncrumple his Abe and Alex, throw it on the table, get 15 chips. He plays the hand. He loses because he always does because people that buy in short repeatedly just suck. And they keep losing, and they keep pulling out another $15. And it doesn't allow the rest of us who are playing with a proper bankroll to play the game the way it should be. Because we're never going to be able to bet this guy off a hand, all right? Because we know he's going to be all in every single hand. And I just think that's wrong.
Well,
let me have it.
What? No. I don't think it's wrong. It's just what's the minimum that's acceptable?
Well, all right, here's the thing. I already think that the buy-ins... Again, I'm a limit player. I mean, we can talk about no limit. That's a little different story, I think. But from a limit standpoint, I already think the minimum buy-ins are pretty low. In most places, they're 10 times the small bet. You know, so for a 4A game, it's $40.
Right.
For a game, it's $20. I would never buy in for those games for that amount. All right? If you got a gun to my head and I'm playing 2-4, I'm buying in for at least 60. You know, if I'm 3-6, I'm buying in for 100. 4-8, I'm probably going to buy in for 200. I just like to have enough chips that I can see a hand all the way to the end. And there's swings in limit poker, so you need to have enough that, obviously you never need $200 in a hand. But, you know, you lose a couple hands, you're down to 100, and now you got a cushion. So I already think those are too low. But I would think, here's the thing. I will grant you, if I'm the wizard of poker, which someday I am, I'm working so hard at that, I am going to allow you one short rebuy, and for no less than half of the minimum buy-in. I think that is fair. Because here's the thing, if you are a player and, you normally, when I go bust one of those games, I'll just peel off another 100, right? But maybe I've been playing all day, my luck's just bad, I peeled off my last 100, and I look at my wallet and I've got $36. I shouldn't be penalized, I shouldn't have to be made to go up into the ATM to get another 100 out, I can put that 36 on. But I shouldn't be able to put that 36 on and let's go, oh, guess what, I found another 27 in my pocket, here you go. Oh, here's another 15 in my shoe. I'm putting that on. All right, one short rebuy out of respect for you for being at the game and playing for a while. But it has to be at least the minimum, half of the minimum.
So you're saying they would throw you like a lammer or something to say, okay, he's bought in or he's got his full buy-in once already, so he's allowed one.
Because dealer switch and stuff is probably tough. And I know there are some rooms that allow you one short rebuy, so I don't know exactly how they do it. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time paying attention to this. It really, on this trip, I saw it a lot.
Yeah.
And I really said, this is crazy. This guy, he obviously has money, all right, because he's reaching his pocket 12 times. Why couldn't he just not reach in his pocket one time and put that all on and then play until it's done?
He likes to.
Not too much to ask.
Yeah, well, he likes not to risk a lot of money.
Well, I know.
You know what I mean? It's not right.
He likes to take a shot.
It's an angle shot. Yeah.
And that's the other part that I don't like about it.
Oh, I agree with you. I just again, I don't know how they can regulate that with the like you said with the moving dealers and
letting you buy in short. That's one way.
No, I know, but again, there's a minimum. So now what? We have taken a consensus on what the minimum is acceptable to all poker players, or.
If what you're saying is it's complicated, and I'm not saying you're wrong, because you're right, you'd probably involve a lammer or something, fine, just don't allow short buys at all, that's fine. I mean, I can live with the fact that in the scenario I gave you where I've lost $200 and I only have 36 in my pocket and want to be able to put it on out of respect, that's fine, I'll give that up.
Right.
Sure, I'll walk over to the ATM and get it, if that's what it takes to solve this problem. But I think from the operator standpoint, too, you know, because I'm always thinking of this from the operator standpoint, too. I mean, that slows the game down. That's rake they're losing.
Yeah, you're right.
Every time they make a deal or cut out $15 in chips at a 4-8 full kill Omaha game, they're missing another hand, potentially. You know, it's going to add up over the time.
What about
just tell that guy, hey, if you only got $15, I'm sorry, we just don't want your business.
Can you figure out what a capped on all streets bet would be? So in other words, that would be the minimum amount you could buy in for. So that you would have to, you know, in other words, capped at pre-flop, capped after the flop, capped after the turn, capped after the river, how much would that money be, say, in a 1-2 game? And then that money is the amount, the minimum that you should buy in, you can buy in for.
Well, yeah, I understand that. But, I mean, that might be too much. I mean, here's the thing. Here's the reason they have, I think they have such low minimum buy-ins. I mean, you want to make the game accessible. I mean, how many emails have we gotten from listeners saying, hey, you know, I've been playing the bar leagues, I'm crushing them, I'm ready to step up, I'm just a little worried about putting X amount of money into play. Mm-hmm. All right, and the higher you make that minimum buy-in, the more of a barrier you put between letting those players get comfortable playing and not playing. So I'm not necessarily opposed to the minimum buy-in necessarily. Like I said, I already think it's a little low, but whatever. So I if you do the whole cap, then I think then that minimum buy-in explodes on you. And in reality, there's never – well, I shouldn't say never. Rarely do you see a hand where it's capped all the way to the head. So
no, I know, but it's possible. What I'm saying is if it was a 1-2 game, the blinds would be 50 cents on a dollar. So pre-flop, it would be a $4 max raise total. So it'd be four. Then after the flop, it'd be four more. So right. You're looking at $8. And then on a turn, it would be 16. So you're looking at 24. And then 16 again is what, $40 or whatever we're saying? So, or what, 16, 32? So, I mean, it's not that much money to ask if you're buying in for $40 or whatever it is, you know, into a 1-2 game. $40 is not a lot of money. And that, if you're playing 1-2, $40 is not a lot. So then if you double the 2-4, then 80 or whatever it is, not that much money either. So I don't know. I agree with you. I think that they need to find some money where some level where that it's not taking that long to burn through all the money, but it's also an amount that people can afford. You know, if, let's say the 4-8 game was the only game in town, and they had to buy in for 200 or something. That's crazy. You know, if you're trying to learn the game, people don't try to learn the game with $200 if they're just a working man who's making minimum wage or something. So I'm trying to find the right number, and I thought maybe that might be it, if you cap it on every street, and that's the buy-in that you have to minimum for. I don't really know what the number is. I guess it's...
Okay. Yeah, I'm not so much worried about the minimum buy-in. It's just I'm trying to stop the...
48, I guess, is the 1-2.
The serial short rebuys. And maybe it's, you know, I know we're all into fairness in this country and stuff, so maybe this won't fly, but I think at some point, you know, I guess it's the same thing with, you know, any kind of other angle shoot. Eventually, if there's a pattern established, you know, you call a floor over and say, hey, this guy is short-bought in for at least 3 times during my down.
Yeah.
You know, and hey, sir, I understand that you're buying in. We love your business, but can you just buy in for a reasonable amount going forward or take your business elsewhere?
Yeah.
I think that would be a fine way of dealing with it as well, too. But hey, like I said, I mean, most rooms don't. I mean, I really don't notice this that often. I've noticed it probably in 2 rooms, one here in Florida and then obviously on this trip on California. So maybe I'm making a mountain out of a molehill.
Because in No Limit Hold'em, it's a lot of fun to see you guys do that. Because I had a couple of the biggest nights of my life with guys who just kept buying in for 20 who were drunk when I was playing like a 1-2 or a. I think it was the Tampa Bay Downs 50-cent dollar game or whatever that time. And I was waiting for you to like go out in a tournament or something. I was playing cash and it was like 50-cent a dollar. And I started with $50 and I ended up leaving with like $600, $700 or something because these people kept buying in for 20 and then going all in on crappy
hands.
Yeah,
I mean,
great.
Here's the flip side. And I'm glad you brought that up because I'm sure we got some emails about this too. Don't get me wrong. I know people that do this suck. All right. And they're good for your bankroll. So maybe, you know, I should quit tapping on the aquarium on this and just let the guy keep, you know, reaching his pocket for $15 knowing that it's going to end up in my stack anyhow or on the table somewhere where I can get it. And you're right. I mean, I played the room I've been in where they do this all the time. It's No Limit. And actually, I loved it. I love playing it that way because I don't like playing No Limit, and it played like Limit at that point when everybody on the table has $20 in front of them.
Right.
You know, I can't get pushed off a hand, and again, those players suck. You know, I mean, that's what it comes down to. So, I mean, I'm arguing against something that could help my. I don't like to be irritated when I'm playing. You know.
Yeah, I know.
I just go. I like to have a good time. I'm a recreational player. I like to win money, but I like to have fun, win or lose, and. These kind of jerks just kill me, you know?
Yeah, and that's when you miss online poker, too, because it's, it's you know, there's only so much you can do, and on top of it, you get hands quickly. You know, you don't have to wait for people to rebuy and take all this time and cut out the chips and all that. You know, when you're playing online poker, none of this happens.
All right, well, you know, we're trying to bury the full tilt debate today, right?
Yeah.
And now let's have a moment of silence and bury the winners paying the rake debate. We're going to let our good friend Gundam have the last word. Well, second to last word, because of course I'm going to say something after his call. but he called into our hotline at 813-448-1120, catching up on some old shows. And he's rekindling this debate, but we're not going to let him. I'm going to explain to him why he's wrong, and we're going to move on as a family.
All right, let's do it.
The people who pay the rake are the people where the rake amount is going to affect them most. And a person who doesn't win a pot the entire night is not at all affected by the rake. Doesn't matter if the rake was $1 billion or $0, they paid the same amount of rake. Their profits or losses weren't affected. But a person who wins pots, a whole bunch of pots during the night, and typically is the winner for the night, the profits that he makes differ considerably compared to how much rake was paid. So it's obvious that the people who win the pots pay the rake. The losers do not pay the rake.
All right, first of all, Gundam, come on. I love arguing with you, buddy. But let's come to an agreement here. Let's not words like, it's obviously this way, when it's not obviously this way. All right? This is a legitimate debate. You have a point of view. I have a point of view. Neither one of us is obviously right. All right? But here's the thing, I think people are going to get confused about this, too. Mechanically, yes, the winners pay the rake, right?
Right.
I mean, think of it this way. If properly, what the room could do is push the entire pot to the winner and then ask them to give 10% back or whatever, you know, 10% to $5, whatever, and give it back to the dealer, right?
Right.
They just cut out the middleman and just take it themselves. So, yes, from a physical, mechanical standpoint, sure, the winners pay the rake. I think what we are talking about is more philosophy of who's paying the rake. And again, I think there is a compelling case to be made, not an obviously wrong case to be made, that if you walk out of the room with more money than you came into the room with, you won. Which is what we said, right?
Yep.
If you walk out of the room with less money than you walked into it, you lost. And that's really what it comes down to for me, philosophically. Now, obviously, we talked, you know, ad nauseum about certainly a rake could get prohibitive and blah, 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 and everybody loses. But I did think we wanted to make that point that mechanically, yes, the winners pay the rake. But it's not obvious that overall, philosophy-wise, that they're paying the rake.
Well, the other thing, too, is I don't want to rekindle this, okay? I really don't.
Then stop right now.
But think about it from a timed rake standpoint instead. When every pot you win all the money, but everybody at the table is paying $5 every half hour.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's paid their rake out of their own chip stack. So, okay, we've all paid it equally. So now who's paying the rake? We all are. We're all paying the rake. And if you're good enough to win, you're good enough to win. And if you're not, you lose. So when you leave and you leave with more money, you're not paying more rake than anyone else. We're all paying the same rake,
okay.
And then you're taking the money from everyone else. So you're not paying more rake if you're playing in a timed rake, and it's the same example. You're just winning more pots, so you're paying more rake. But what about when you're playing in a timed rake game, which if you're a good player, you're probably playing in higher no limits anyway, and you are paying a timed rake. So, I can see what he's saying, but what he's saying is that, and I'm not going to read into Gundam's mind because that's not something I'll do. But, yeah, every time you win, you're paying the rake with the pot that you won. But you won, and you won more than they're taking from you, and you're taking it from bad players. Essentially, it's their money that's going to the rake, and you're taking off the fat, and you're taking the lean stuff for yourself. So, I know what he's saying. We all know what you're saying. We all know that, yes, when you win a pot and it's a per-pot rake, yes, the winning player paid the rake with their money. But really, you didn't. We all paid equally because we were all putting money into the pot, and we're all getting some of that money taken away. So the timed rake is a perfect example. When it's timed, we all pay exactly the same amount. You are not paying the rake. We all are paying the rake. So let's just move on.
Time rake. I like it. Good way to finish. All right. Well, Gundam obviously is getting swag. But a reminder for everyone else, if you call our hotline at 813-448-1120, obviously we will send you some wonderful swag if you haven't already been sent some, like an uncut sheet of J Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Ante Up. And remember, you can only win the uncut sheets, but you can buy those awesome cards in the Ante Up store at anteupstore.com.
Well, we have an interesting mailbag that I just cannot wait for you to read. comes from the UK, Dale Avis. And, yeah, I want to hear you. You've been working on your acting chops, I believe. So
he's from Ipswich. I just want to say Ipswich.
That is a cool name.
You're probably hacking it, too. It's probably got, like, six silent letters in it, right? So he's like, that's not Ipswich, Scott. It's E. Oh, okay, sorry. All right, but you know, I love this email, and I try to cut it down a little bit so this show doesn't go on for 4 hours. But he headlined it, the Resurgence of Lance. Remember Lance?
How could I forget? I named him.
Yes, yes. So this is an old school letter. He's catching up on the old ones, and he says he ran into his own version of Lance. So let me try to do a dramatic reading here. Chris, you can go get a sandwich.
All right, I'm off. Go ahead.
All right, here's what Dale said. I don't know if you remember talking about Lance. Of course we do.
Yes.
Chris named him.
I named him. We played with him on Saturday.
So this is going back a while in terms of the podcast, but I encountered a similar player at a Pump League regional finals. Wow, I wonder, was Gene Hackman coaching there? this guy was insulting, aggressive, rude. Every time he got beat, he'd criticize opponent's play on every street before chucking in his middle pair. Oh, I love those people like that. Probably short buying. Always showing, bluff or otherwise, giving a broad explanation why he had to do what he did. I'm running well with about 38,000 units, blinds are 400, 800, antes at 100 or similar. I'm in middle position, it's fold around to me, and I look down at two red 10s. They're
nice.
Just 10s, by the way.
They're just 10s.
Just 10s. This quote-unquote Lance is next to act, and I notice he's fondling his chips like the fat kid from Goonies.
I'm really not sure what that means.
Was the fat kid from Goonies fondling? Because that...
The truffle shuffle, was that what he's saying? The truffle shuffle?
A lot more interesting now.
He was truffle shuffling his chips, maybe? I don't get it.
So our hero here was expecting a big race. He makes it a 3,200 to go, saying to me he's going to show me how to play a low pocket pair. Thanks, Lance. The next two players fold, small blind calls, big blind folds. Also, obviously I call winning to shove my middle pair down the guy's throat. See, this is the vengeance of full tilt. Right? Not just enough to win. You got to make them pay for it.
That's right.
It's fairly even in terms of stack size. With me and the minor ship leader, the flop comes 10 of spades, 5 of diamonds, 5 of spades. Hassan Habib! Really going old school there. When would Joe Seabock be on the show?
Oh, my
That's
God.
The Lance was?
Jeez.
I checked to Lance, who suddenly started leaning at the table, barely able to control himself. Pocket fives? Really? He looks at me and the other guy on the hand and says something like, guess you missed that, huh, boys? They put 16,000 in the middle. He's only left himself about 10,000 behind, and by making such an overbet, I assume he's missed and trying to push us off. His low pocket, maybe four spades, three spades.
No. His low pocket pair may be fours or threes. That's dramatic.
That is dramatic. Surely, and quit calling me Shirley, if he had the nuts, he'd make a smaller bet and look like a feeler so someone might raise or do whatever to gain the most out of the hand by committing over half of his stack. I'm a bit confused. Big blind folds, I smooth call. We know what that means.
Yeah, we do.
Hoping to let Lance hang himself on the turn. Let me tell you something about Lance. He doesn't hang himself. He hangs you. All right, Lance laughs and tells me that he knew I'd call and proceeded to tell me nearly word for word my thought process leading to my call. I'd been had. The turn comes a six of clubs. I check, and so does Lance.
Huh.
I look to him, and he shrugs, winks, and says that he got me on the river. He'll get me on the river. Which comes to 10 of clubs. Hassan Habib! I put Lance all in, thinking I'd be foolish to listen to this idiot on the previous streets, and he'd surely fold. He calls. Stands up laughing and says, your 3-10s aren't good here. And drops the five of clubs, five of hearts, face up onto the table. He leans forward, puts his arms around the pot, about to drag the chips over when I get up, shaking my head. I say, you're right. You beat 3-10s. He doesn't even look up, sneering with the chips halfway to his chest. But not four, I say, and drop the 10 of hearts right in the middle of his arms. Sorry, Lance. Maybe next time.
That's just cruel.
Scene.
End scene. You know, it reminds me of that MASH episode when Radar says, I had two pair.
You want to film the Temecula?
Yes. He says, I have two pair. And they're like, what were they? He says, tens. He says, tens. What was the other pair? He goes, that's it, tens. Two red ones and two black ones. So that's exactly what this guy had. He had two red tens, and then two black tens came on the board. So, pretty cool. Although, you know, in Lance's defense, he just got really mad. That was it. He didn't make fun of anybody.
Yeah, that's true. He wasn't a jerk.
He just got really mad.
Heated.
Yeah, heated. But it's pretty funny. Nothing like getting quads over quads. I wonder if there's a bad beat in the UK.
Yeah, in this Pub Poker League.
Pub Poker League regional finals.
Art tab or something, yeah. Yeah, the regional finals. They're going to move on to French Lick next week.
That's right. And remember, sit on each other's shoulders and measure. The rim is still 10 feet there.
Forget about their fancy uniforms,
that's
Chris.
That's right. We don't care.
And remember about the swag shelf. Because Dale from Ipswich is going to get a download of Poker Hand Breakdown Pro Hand History Analysis Program for single or mixed games from element26.net. And that is a wonderful prize that you out there, and I'm talking to you listeners, can qualify for by merely sending us a comment to podcast@andyupmagazine.com.
Hey, our call to floor returns. Comes from Mark via email. It says, I was playing in a 1-2 no-limit hold'em game in a Las Vegas casino. I raise, and the big blind called. After the flop, he says, I check raise. I bet, and he folds. Had he not folded, would he have been compelled to raise me based on his statement?
No, Mark, you would have been compelled to have you slap that smile off his face. Oh, I'm sorry, we're asking Jody now.
Yeah, we're asking Jody. We're not giving our opinion yet.
All right, here's what Jody says. Quote, I check raise is a ridiculous statement. Thank you, Jody. End of argument. Oh, I'm sorry. He goes on.
He's got more to say.
It's a ridiculous statement people make in an effort to be funny. I like how he says in an effort to be funny. Not to be funny. You know, because I tell my wife, hey, that was funny. She's like, no. You were making an effort.
Yeah, you were trying to be funny.
He says, there's nothing binding about this statement. Consider this. In tournament play, if a player acts at a turn and his action is only binding if the action hasn't changed, when is that player's proper turn to act? Based on this rule, a declaration of check raise cannot be enforced, since the action has to change before the raise can be made. Anytime I hear someone say this, I usually assume that they have a really weak hand and most likely will fold as soon as possible. Bear in mind that there is probably a room out there somewhere that does force players to raise in cash games when they make this statement, but in most rooms, that should not be the case.
All right. Makes sense.
All right, so we're in agreement. Just douchebag.
Yeah. Deutschbag.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, man. You have to throw the Deutsche Bank flag on me now.
You're all fired up, man. You're all fired up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we need. You know, that should be our next giveaway for Andy Up. Deutsche Bank flags. You know, kind of like the Southwest bag fee thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're in a poker room and someone makes a Deutsche Bank move or comment. You can stand up whistle and whoosh, throw this flag at him. Have our logo on it and everything. Listen to Andy Up PokerCast to find out how big of a Deutsch you are.
You know, this whole show has been basically reader-fueled. Reader and listener-fueled.
Those are the best ones.
Yeah. And we got another one. This comes from... He's our ambassador. Because we have ambassadors. All, and a lot of our listeners are ambassadors. This comes from Don Matasovsky. And he's our ambassador down in St. Louis.
Yeah, and he's writing it about... You know, we talked about the wait list. And Michael Cantor over in Cannes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jurassic Con.
He was saying that was a while-ish. That was a few weeks ago too. We're doing all this like Redux stuff today. It's pretty hilarious.
Redux.
He says, I was first on the wait list at a Harris casino one time and a seat opened up. They called someone else and I told the brush that I was next. He said he had to give the seat to the other guy, but would tell me why in a minute. The guy that took my seat had a 7-star total rewards card.
Oh my god, so bizarre.
And one of the privileges is jumping the top of the list. That is sort of like giving the seat to a regular, like in our example that we talked about with Michael. He says, my guess is that this happens all the time, but people don't realize when they get bumped. Yeah, it's funny. When I'm like the type of person, when I get my name on a list, I sit there and stare at the list and burn a hole into it with my eyes until my name gets called. So I would notice if they jumped over me, but I can see where if, you know, you sit down in another game waiting for your name to get called, or and you're just waiting to hear it rather than checking who's ahead of you and stuff. So I can see how it's probably 50-50, but I sit there and just stare at the thing and basically stand right next to the brush and wait because I want to get in, you know. So
yeah, yeah, usually when they get to the ska part of Scott, I'm like, here!
Yeah, I know, me too.
Got my money out of my hand. Give me my chips.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I never thought about that. But, you know, hey, we're hearing more and more benefits to being a Total Rewards whore here. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And free food and rooms and stuff. So, I mean, it's a powerful program. Now I know I can just walk to the front of the line.
Yeah, I know what you learned a lot about more. There's some more stuff going on in Southern California, I think. The hair is there, and San Diego, whatever. So, yeah, we'll talk more about that on next week's show, I think. But, yeah, you're right. This Total Rewards thing is blowing up.
All right, the super fastest housekeeping segment ever on our show. Remember, we need a couple more ambassadors. Specifically, we're looking for folks based near Seattle and someone based near Detroit. If you're interested in joining our team, apply at andy@magazine.com/ambassadors. And don't forget the cruise coming up. You probably can still get you on for 619. It sails December 10th out of New Orleans. And go to andy@magazine.com/cruise to find out more details. We are nearing 100 passengers, Chris.
7 nights, right?
7 nights.
Do the math, man. That's less than $100 a day. Do it.
Well, less than $100 a day.
Yeah, well less.
You get food.
You know, our Andy Up News Desk took a break last week, just like everyone else does on this show, but it's back. So what's going on this week?
Yeah, I think we're making up for it this week. We got some stuff to talk about here. All right, first of all, the White House's We the People initiative promises to research issues that receive the most petition signatures. A Poker Player Alliance petition to study online poker quickly passed the first litmus test to qualify for the study, but its recently lost steam is now 26th, the 26th top issue behind other issues including marijuana legalization and recognition of the existence of extraterrestrials. Deadline to sign up is October 22nd.
When I saw this, I clicked the link on our site and went to the home, because I voted, or not voted, but I signed it. And so, yeah, because when you go there, if you already signed it, you can't click sign because it won't let you. So, and it actually lists every single person who signed it and where they're from and everything. It's pretty interesting.
Really?
So anyway, as of this morning, it was like 8,300 people. And I thought, I know why, because the litmus test was 5,000, right? So once people knew that they had gotten past the 5,000, they just like, all right, they're going to look into it now, so I don't need to sign it. That's not right! Because apparently they are giving it a hierarchy here, and if we can't beat the people wanting to know about Area 51, then what the hell? I thought this was about making money for the country and trying to find ways to pay off this huge debt. What? How are we going to contact E.T. and ALF and make this any different for our situation here on this planet? Come on!
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is the thing that drives me crazy, is because people bitch and moan about government left and right, right? And then you know, there was some idiot in the White House that said, hey, let's do this We the People initiative and tell people to ask us what we should study. And everybody's like, ah, all you're going to get is the potheads writing in. And the guy's like, no, trust me, this is going to be cool. And they're like, all right, fine. And they put it out there, and sure, the potheads come out of everywhere. And then, this is how we show the government that we are a serious citizenry. We value saying hi to Ewoks more than getting online poker passed.
I know, that's what I was saying. It's like, hello? Is ALF really going to make a difference in our gross national product or whatever? I mean, I just don't
really, seriously, people are out there going, oh, my God, the economy's in the crapper. I haven't worked in 3 years. You know, we're fighting civil rights issues. But, no, more important is that Spock can land at Cape Canaveral safely. That's what we need to get finished.
I know. I want to kick back with a bong and hang out with, you know, Captain Spock. You know, whatever, Shatner, whatever the hell his name is. I don't listen to the trailer things, whatever. But, yeah, I mean, come on. Please, just, if you guys haven't signed it, sign it.
I am going to be mortified if E.T. coming home ends up being more valuable to our citizenship than online poker. I'm sorry. So, folks, please, all 7 of you out there still listening, go there and help us overturn the Terminator here. And I will be a happy camper.
Can you believe what? 25 things beat online poker regulation. Look at those things. That means that, oh my God, 25 things got 8,500 signatures or more. 25 other things.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, if you would tell me that online poker is the 26th most important issue to Americans, I would have no problem with that. All right, because, right. You know, legitimately, I mean, obviously we're much closer to this issue and we understand why it's important to do this. But, you know, the average person, you know, online poker doesn't really rate that high. All right. But then when you look at the list, you're like, come on.
I know.
Come on.
Well, the other thing, too, is it's not that it's not important to us. All kinds of stuff's important to me. Right. But I was thinking of this as, how are we going to turn our country around list? Not, hey, list. I'm real interested in, you know, the flow rate of ketchup on a plate. Just as much as anybody. But really, it's not that important to me to save the country. You know? I want to know how we can save this country and make some money. And I'm pretty sure that watching, you know, Heinz ketchup versus Hunt's going down a plate is not going to save it.
I tell you, there have been just some knockdown, drag-out fights on the ketchup flow on the plate forum. And I'm just so glad to hear I'm not the only one vastly interested in that. Oh, you're killing me.
Oh, my God. All right. South Point Casino in Las Vegas, Barona Resort near San Diego, which we visited. This trip was really cool. And a cooperative effort between San Manuel Casino and Morongo Resort in Southern California have all recently launched free play poker websites.
Yeah, it's like, you know, jumping on the bandwagon here. Everybody's doing it.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, why not? I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's probably a reasonable debate over what you're getting out of it, you know, other than...
Well, they're just laying the groundwork, that's all.
Yeah, I think that's really what it is. It's just, you know, hey, if we can build our infrastructure and get a listener base, I mean, not a listener base, but a player base, then we can flip the switch on real money.
Yeah.
You know, after we make sure that the pigs in space are taken care of.
That's right. Pigs in space.
Then we'll be good to go with online poker. So, but yeah, I'd be interested to see who else comes up with these, because, you know, it's not going to end here. There's going to be several more of these come up. And then you've got, like, player fractured. I mean, no one's going to sign up for all these, are they?
No, I don't think so.
Is there going to be an advantage to playing over one free play site over another one? I don't know. Maybe. We'll see. But, All right, well, finally, Sopranos actress Drea D'Amato.
Hey, pretty good.
Sexy and smart player in an illegal high-stakes poker game on a November sweeps episode of CSI.
Forget about it.
Yeah, see, they could have left out the sexy part, because obviously that's guaranteed. She's an attractive woman. Now, smart.
Okay.
I mean, she wasn't smart on Joey either, was she?
I didn't watch.
You didn't watch Joey? As much as you go, oh, how are you doing? You didn't watch the spinoff?
Yeah, no.
Oh, okay.
No. Was it around long enough for me to even catch it on TV? I can't remember.
Probably not. Yeah, it's probably right. It's probably not even on Netflix or Quickster or whatever they call themselves these days.
Yeah, no, I didn't watch it, sorry. Hey, you know, O'Malley's move came back last week pretty strong. And what we're going to do is we're going to listen to that first part again, give our little reaction, see what people are saying on the forums about it, and then we'll listen to the result and give us our final sort of thought on it. So here we go.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. We're back at the $1, $2, No Limit Hold'em casino cash game. The action's been fairly stable all night, and the atmosphere has been friendly and jovial. Our opponents are mostly in their 60s and older, except for one couple playing at the table who are probably about in their mid-30s. But as for the 60s and over, they play super tight, and for the most part, pretty passive. There's a lot of trapping going on at any opportunity. The blinds post, and it gets folded around to the plus 3 position, who makes the standard 6x raise to $12 with about 425 behind. He only bought in for 100 and has been having a good night. The plus 4 folds, and we're in the hijack seat with 8 of hearts, 8 of diamonds. We bought in for 500, the table max, and currently have around 570. What's good about our opponent is he plays a very predictable style of poker. He's raising in middle position with a pair of 10s or higher, ace-king or ace-queen, maybe something like king-queen, but that's stepping a bit too much outside of his comfort zone. While of his 8-hand range, 5 of them beat us, we're going to make this call. Under normal circumstances, putting $12 in the pot for the 1-in-8 chance of hitting our set wouldn't be worth it. But this opponent doesn't seem to be able, or willing, to lay down an overpair or top pair when he gets it. So if a scenario like that were to happen, we'd get his entire stack. So the pot odds aren't there to make this call, but the implied odds sure are. We put in the $12, cut off folds, the button calls, the female half of the younger couple. The small blind folds, and the big blind calls. We weren't anticipating so many people in this hand, but it bodes well for our middling pair. Honestly, we wouldn't have this any other way. There's $49 in the pot, and the flop comes king of diamonds, king of clubs, 8 of spades. There is our ricky-ticky-tavi flop, losing only to king-king or king-eight, but we're feeling 100% comfortable right now. The big blind checks, as does the plus 3, and now it's to us with one of the toughest decisions in poker. How to eke out the most money possible when you flopped a huge hand. The original raiser could be slow playing something, ready to trap, but the hunter is about to become the hunted. The only problem is we can't seem too anxious. If we bet, and he has something like ace-queen, tens, or jacks, he's just gonna muck. So we decide $30 isn't too scary of a bet. Very welcoming for a hand like queens, and we might even get a smaller pair to tag along. The button folds, the big blind folds, and our plus 3 makes the call. The pot is 109, and the turn is the 4 of hearts. This card's a blank as far as we're concerned. And now is when our plus 3 decides to spring his trap on us, pushing in $75. We don't want to scare this meal off just yet, but still, we have to get as much out of him as we can. We do the dreaded min raise to 150, praying he won't see right through it, as there are no draws on this board for him to put us on. Our opponent plays with his chips for a time, almost pondering if he wants to put it all in the middle or wait until the river. We're fine either way. He decides to just flat call, still thinking he's the hunter. The pot is now ballooned to 409, and the river is the jack of diamonds. Without any hesitation at all, our opponent pushes his remaining 225 into the pot. I know this seems like an insta-call, but there's no need to rush this decision. Since now we only have the 6th nuts, we need to think about his possible hands before making this decision. And that's where we end off this week. A call and loss would only leave us 150 behind, and we'd be reeling. A win would put us on the plus side big time. So what are we doing here?
All right, I agree with O'Malley. I don't think this is an insta-call.
Yeah.
So I thought about it a little bit. King-king, jack-jack, king-jack are all in our opponent's range. And based on how this player's been described to us, which is all we can go off of here, right?
Yeah.
He would have played this hand just like this with all three. Probably a little less likely a jack-jack. But he could also easily have ace-king or king-queen here. So for me, I'm not trying to dodge the question. I'm not trying to make O'Malley make his move on his own here. But to me, this is one of those classic poker gut check decisions that you just have to stare into your opponent's soul and make a good decision. You know, does he have one of these couple hands that beats us, or does he have all these other hands that don't beat us?
I just, like you said, given what we know about him, I wouldn't put him on king-jack. That's the hand. So because you offered that up as a possibility. Raising with predictable, with quality hands, I don't think king-jack's quality hand, so I don't think he would be playing that. But the other ones, yeah, they're possible. It just seems like the action leading up to the shove really felt, to me, and the note I had written last week was screams ace-king. So I have to go with my gut, and my gut is it felt like ace-king from the beginning, and it plays like ace-king the way he's playing it. So I went with ace-king on this hand and said I would probably call. probably with little hesitation. And it's just me. I mean, maybe if it was for my house and a car, maybe I wouldn't. But for the buy-in that I have and the amount of money I have in front of me, I think that I'm ahead here. And
well, guess what, Chris? It's not just you.
All right.
I know you're going to have trouble believing this, but you and Rant agree.
No way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, Rant and I usually agree, though. We usually agree on things.
I'm getting a little jealous. You're stealing him from me, and I don't like that. He's supposed to be mad at me, not you.
Hey, no, I'm sorry about that.
But, you know, maybe I think if I understood you correctly, you said that our opponent stole this hand with Ace-King, right? He was stealing from us, right?
No, I didn't say
that. Okay, because that's what Rant's going to think you said.
Oh, okay. No, I do believe he has Ace-King, though. I just feel so strongly about that.
All right, well, here's what Rant says. I don't see how we can fold considering the villain can have Ace-King and maybe King-Queen. I don't see how he could have Jack-Jack when he calls the turn race. I think so, but I won't get into that. Sure, he can have King-King, but that's one combo compared to eight combos of Ace-King. Even adding King-Jack to his range only adds six combos. So given the odds we're getting, we can only fold if we're convinced that the villain very rarely does this with Ace-King and never does this with hands like Ace-Ace or Queen-Queen. I don't see how a fold could possibly be correct.
Yeah, I didn't think so either. So let's see what's going on in part two.
Hello again. This seems like a no-brainer, but we overanalyze this hand to death. The more we think about it, the easier the call becomes. We can rule out King Jack, King 8, and King 4 since our opponent is not going to raise preflop from middle position with any of these hands. We can also rule out Jacks because there's no way he calls our bet on the flop and our raise on the turn. And we're not scared of Queens since we have them crushed. That really leaves us with our opponent having one of four possible hands. Aces, Ace King, King Queen, though that's probably not very likely, or quads. We beat three out of four of his hands now, and we're just not that worried about pocket kings here. Call it courage, or just plain stupidity. We push in the 225, and our opponent tables the King of Hearts and the Ace of Clubs. Our stomach did a somersault, as his king was hiding the ace at first, but we breathe a sigh of relief when we table our boat and scoop the pot. We take some heat from the table for taking so long to make what they consider an easy call, and one guy even accuses us of slow rolling and Hollywooding. I guess the jovial atmosphere is long gone. In the end, we did the right thing by taking our time and logically thinking through the haze to the right move, and they can moan about that all they want. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley, and I hope to see you on the felt.
All right, I agree. It looks easy now. And maybe it was, but here's the thing. I think the shove on the river is what gave me pause. But really, really, to me, the best thing that happened here was we slowed down, took our time, and thought it through. Not to would have been a bigger mistake for me, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I know these people, give you such gruff for taking some time to think about it. You know, I'm not going to give people gruff anymore for taking time to think about it because obviously they're considering more than I'm considering. So, I mean, there's very few situations that are instant calls, I think.
Yeah, and obviously I'm standing by what I wrote because I was right.
You're right.
Yeah.
Fine. Brag.
But no, but the other thing here is I didn't go through as much that of the way to get to my reasoning as Rant did, but when you compare the all, so when you say that it's easy now, it looks easy now, why do you say that? Why wasn't it easier for you back when you were first hearing the part? Was it just because you really wanted to go through all those possibilities and you don't like playing Nolan and Hold'em?
Well, no, again, I think to me it was the river thing. I mean, I know there's a good debate over the river, but to me, this kind of player, this ABC kind of player that plays the big hands, I could see him being a little cautious with his King Jack when we raise, thinking, hey, maybe he's up against King Queen or Ace King.
Right.
When the Jack hits, going, I got you. trying to maximize the money, or betting smaller and letting you try to raise him or something like that. It just seems to me like, hey, I hit my hand, boom, I'm getting it in. Call me if you want.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what made me think.
Okay. All right, well, that's fair enough.
But, an ABC player, I think that's how they would play that hand.
That's fair enough. But
it looks easy now.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. And again, it's just I play a lot more by feel than I do anything else, and it just didn't feel like anything else. I felt like he would have valued bet on the end if he had something beat me. So Very good, O'Malley. Look for another one next week.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, well, Chris, we didn't pack 76 poker rooms into 7 days this time.
No.
Thank God. Although it felt like it, didn't it?
It did. It did. It was remarkable.
But our 10-day odyssey was clearly our craziest. We visited more than 30 poker rooms, took 9 plane trips, rented 5 cars, stayed in 7 hotel rooms, and drove countless miles. I probably could have counted them, but...
Yeah, it was a lot.
It was taking me another 10 days just to count that, so...
And one of my favorite things is when we walked up to a poker room and we're like... Yeah, is Joe Schmo here? We were supposed to meet with him today, and they're like, oh, we don't know where he is. I'm like, look, all right, we're on a 10-day odyssey, all right? We took 9 plane trips to get here, rented 5 cars, and stayed in 7 hotel rooms, including one where the boombox wouldn't shut off till 4 a.m. in the room next door. You're going to go get the poker room manager. That was basically what I'm like, we're from Antioch Magazine. We're writing a story about your room.
3,000 miles to see you.
We flew 3,000 miles to see you. You are going to go get the manager. I don't care if he's got egg salad on his face from eating the sandwich. You're going to bring him out here, and we're going to tell him he has the paprika in his cheek. I don't care.
Oh, you're killing me today.
Remove the parsley from your teeth, pal, and give me a couple minutes of your time, because we're going to write about this room, and you don't want us to write anything negative, so...
All right, of course, this trip is probably important to know, unlike
the Vegas trip,
the awesome one, where we actually were trying to hit every single room. We obviously didn't do that this time. We hit the biggest. So there are a lot more rooms in these areas than we're going to talk about, so be sure you go to our Where to Play page on AndyUpMagazine.com for a complete list of map if you feel like going out there. And that's really what we're trying to accomplish here. It's kind of a little travel log.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So we're going to go out of order a little bit and try to package the shows so they make sense from a travel standpoint, even though it would be fun to kind of retrace our steps. But you can go back to our Twitter feed probably and still do that. Maybe.
Right. It's only 4 days, right? 4 days.
Oh, okay.
I don't
too bad. You should have followed it when we were alive. All right, today we're going to do the Los Angeles market and some overall thoughts on the whole trip. And then in the coming weeks, we'll tackle the rest of Southern California, Northern California, Arizona, and, of course, St. Louis, which you always think of when you think of California and Arizona.
Hey, it's one big trip is all it was. So yours was a little longer than mine, but it was one big trip, and that was where it took us. Los Angeles seems like the perfect way to start. It's the place that everyone, you know, when you think of the Mecca or whatever you want to call it of poker, L.A. is really, you know, I was real excited to go there because I'd never been there before, and they have card rooms. It's right. Not really, even though they call them casinos, there are casinos, but it's all card related, right? Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yeah. The difference is that the card rooms can only have card games. So either you're playing traditional poker or stuff like versions of blackjack, pai gal, baccarat, etc. And then there are tribal casinos in the state that are more like your normal casino,
right,
with slot machines and buffets and the shows and stuff, although they can't deal all the same casino games that you see elsewhere. So that's really the difference, is knowing whether it's a card room or whether it's a casino. And for a poker player, it probably doesn't really matter too much, other than the card rooms obviously are bigger. I mean, some of these places are 180 tables.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Can't even think about that. I mean, that's more tables in the one room than in some states.
You know, in most states. One of my favorite things, though, was seeing the roulette version where they had cards on the roulette wheel and like one of those little flicker things that
made me feel like I was riding my bike.
Exactly. Like I had a card of, you know, Willie Mays rookie year in my spokes, and it was, that was hilarious. That was the coolest thing on the trip. One of the coolest things.
Well, yeah, you see the ingenuity of casino operators. You know, you tell them what the rules are, they'll find a way to take it all the way to the edge.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, actually, I was like curious. I had heard that, you know, people were always, you know, laughing about how you play craps in California. It's dealt with cards, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that takes all the fun out of it. The fun of it's throwing the dice, and I get there, and people are throwing the dice.
Yeah.
But then they turn over cards to the table, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. This is awesome. You guys are so smart out here.
I really didn't pay attention too much to that. Now, when they threw the dice, were the numbers that came up on the dice, the cards that they pushed out, is that how they did it? I can't remember.
You know, we just walked by quickly.
Yeah.
Should have gone back and looked at it more, but we were just so busy.
It was so cool, though. It was so wild. You see these guys playing with cards on the blackjack and the roulette and yeah, and the, of course the craps. It was pretty cool. I enjoyed it.
Now, of course, when you go to Los Angeles, it's all card rooms. I mean, the tribal casinos are elsewhere in the state.
Yeah.
We'll talk about some of those next week. I think the most interesting thing to me in the Los Angeles market was how nice competitors were with each other. And almost to a man, they said, you know, hey, we don't double book tournaments. So, you know, if there's a tournament going on at the bike, the Commerce isn't going to run one. And when the Commerce is doing one, Hustler won't do one. I think that's really, it's kind of cool to see rooms who obviously are fighting over the same player be that friendly to each other. I mean, certainly they want to, you know, beat them, obviously. I mean, I'm not saying that there's any soft play going on here, but I think they have an understanding that the market is better when they can work together on some things.
Yeah, it was funny when we would leave the office of these people, they would say, hey, don't forget to tell Joe that I said hi because we're friends. And it's like, it seemed like every time we were leaving, they would say that we're friends with him or something. And that's true. I mean, and it's to a point, like you said. I do know that a few of them were like, you know, I used to be there, and now my job is to, you know, to rip them a new a-hole or whatever it was they said. You know, it's, and my job is to just end them and whatever, and I'm trying to put them out of business or, you know, whatever. So there was both sides of the coin, but traditionally, or not traditionally, but for the most part, they were like, yeah, we're all friends out here, you know. It was pretty wild.
And the other thing I noticed on this trip, I felt bad because I kept telling you, wait till you get to the Commerce, Chris.
Yeah.
You're going to walk in, and your eyes are going to sparkle. Any kind of game you want to play, you're going to be able to play it. And you got all excited like a kid on Christmas. And we walked in there, and wah, wah, wah. The variety of games just isn't what it was from even when Fasten and I visited out there 4 or 5 years ago, which is the last time I've been out there since then. But the last time I went out there to actually walk into a card room. And just like everywhere else, it's mostly no limit now. Certainly a lot of limit hold'em games, but wasn't a tremendous amount of Omaha that I remembered from last time, and certainly I didn't see any draw games or anything like that. Did you?
No.
At least not in the kiddie pool area that we
played. Yeah, that's the other thing, too, is I only stayed in the kiddie pool. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, the best I found was a 4-8 stud game, and I played it, and that was it. Other than that, everything was... and I think there were 2 4-8 stud games, and one of them broke. The one I broke, actually. I ended up breaking the table because I took too much money from people, which is kind of cool, but it sucked. I actually literally broke 2 people, and that broke the game. They wouldn't find anybody else put on the list. So
just said, hey, I'll let you buy in short.
You got some money in your shoe?
I'm the other publisher. I'm the nice one.
But you're right, there wasn't much variety. It was mostly limit and no limit hold'em on our level of playing. Like I said, right. There were some big mixed games obviously in the big boys room, but I wasn't going to do that. So it was kind of disappointing, and not just on the Commerce. I mean, it was all rooms, really. There was 1 or 2 rooms that had stud 8, and I got to play that, but I played it for, like, minuscule amounts, so I would have preferred to play 4-8 or 5-10 even, but ended up playing 50 cent a dollar because I just wanted to play the game so bad.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're right. L.A. had a ton of rooms and a ton of games, but nothing that really interested me as far as my variety.
Well, you know, one of the things I love traveling about you is you are Hawkeye on the rake. Nothing about the rake gets past my partner, and I don't mean that to mock you. I am truly in awe of the fact that you know exactly what the rake is, and when they're dropping it, I need you at my table all the time to make sure I'm not screwed. But you certainly had some opinions on how they do the rake out there, right?
Well, I just didn't know it, and so it was a shock. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. Of course, our California listeners will all be like, of course this is the way it's done. But, you know, they take the rake based on the number of players that were dealt a hand, not the amount of money in the pot. And they'll automatically take it no matter what if there's a flop. So if there's a flop, and let's say there are 7 players or more, they'll take the full $4 rake, right, automatically. Whether, you know, if we all limped, let's say 2 of us limped, and then a 3rd guy limps, and it's like, and you're playing 1-2 no limit, and there's $6 in the pot, they'll take the $4.
Yeah.
They'll take the $4, and now you're playing to win just your money back, and hopefully that you'll make a bet, and they'll call your bet if you have the hand and win, because if they don't, and you make a bet, all you're winning is your money back, and it's brutal. And so chopping was rampant out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people were like they were probably in the cutoff and like leaning over the button saying, are you guys going to chop if we fold? I mean, that was what was going on, because they knew that if they folded and the guys didn't chop, then, you know, they might as well raise because they know they have two random cards in the blinds. And so they might as well steal the money from you rather than fold and let you guys not chop and just take the money back anyway, you know, whatever it was. So, yeah, based on number of players. So, and then it was a sliding scale. So if it was, I can't remember all the specific breakdowns, but if it was seven or more, it was four.
Yeah.
And it was six.
It was like less. It was like
$3, I think, if it was six. And then for five, it was two. And then four and under was a dollar. So while they encourage you to play shorthanded because you know you're going to lose a dollar,
yeah,
you know, it's such a busy room that you're never going to have a four-handed table. It's never going to happen.
Well, it depends on the game, too. I mean, I guess the part of this I liked is, you know, the thing I hate in a normal poker room is, you know, when the table gets short, which, depending on who you're playing with, can be as many as eight players,
yeah,
or as few as four, then somebody has to be the bold person and go, hey, can I get a rate reduction?
Yeah.
And the dealer has to call the floor over, and then they almost always give it to you or explain why they can't. At least this way, it's automatic, and so you don't, you know, lose a couple of those hands at max rake while you're waiting for the floor guy to come over and reduce it. So I'll give it props for that, but you're right. I'm not a big fan of taking it up front. But, you know, hey, you got to pay for 180 tables somehow, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, and... It's not even so much that it's a flawed system. It just doesn't seem right that the house is making more money. You know, when it's a split pot, hey, that's the rarity of the game. And you know, when you're not playing a split pot game, what I mean. Yeah. When it's a split pot, hey, okay, the house makes more. But when they make more money than you on a regular pot, something's not right there.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem right. It just seems counterintuitive.
You shouldn't lose money when you win the pot.
Yeah.
You know, other than you.
Right, when you win it outright, it should be your pot, and you should win more money than the house. It doesn't make any sense. So,
well, I think one of the interesting things, too, is you had a different... Because I don't think we ever played the same table this entire trip.
No, we didn't.
Well, a little bit at the one, but for the most part, we were at separate tables. And we saw different chop things. I mean, the first time that I got in a chop situation, I turned to the guy next, because I always do. I'm like, hey, are we chopping? And I thought he said no. So, and I had pocket kings. I'm like, all right, screw you.
Yeah.
Raise. And then he threw his cards and took his money back. And the dealer pushed mine back, and I'm like, oh, okay, I guess we're chopping. Maybe I misheard him. And then there's another room where they immediately took the small blind and big blind right after they dealt the cards.
Yeah.
All right, they dealt the cards, under the gun, starting the action. Dealer reaches over, takes both blinds. Puts the three in the rake box and the dollar in the jackpot box. And I think it was a one. Yeah, it's playing 3-6, so it was 1-3. So I'm like, all right, so that means we can't chop. All right, that's fine. And then it gets to me, and I'm in the big blind, and the small blind goes, you want to chop? And I'm like, chop what?
There's no money to chop.
There's nothing in front of me. I'm like, I guess. And then the dealer takes the $3 off the rake box and the dollar off of the jackpot drop and gives it back to us.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, why do that?
Yeah, that's just procedure that they... And sometimes I noticed, too, that the dealers would do it differently. Like, some would put the money right on the pull thing, and then some would just put it to the side or whatever it was. And some didn't do it at all. And it just depended on whether they were lazy or whether they were, you know, their procedure or whatever. But in the same room, though, I noticed dealers doing it differently. So that was kind of weird. But, yeah, I'm not a big fan of the rake being... It's such a reminder... When you see no money out there and you're not playing for money yet, it's like it totally reminds you that they're taking a rake, and you don't want to be reminded of that.
Well, and here's the thing, Chris. You should not complain at all, because the winners pay the rake.
Yeah, I know, and I lost on this trip. So. That's right.
One of the things I thought we both thought were really cool, and again, I think this is just a function of the reality of the situation out there, but the chip renters run around, they have these big fanny packs stuffed with racks of chips.
Yeah, I don't think they're fanny packs, though. They're more like aprons, right? Fanny packs is a little... Well. Fanny packs is what Mike Matisau wears.
All right, big aprons full of racks and chips.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like bombers. You know, they have over the coat, and they have, like, racks of chips there.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first I thought, hey, that's cool. You know, they're saving a little time. They don't have to go up to the cage to get you your chips. But then I went to cash out, and boom, this guy's right on me. You need to cash out? Sure. And he took all my chips and paid me out right there.
Yeah, that was the coolest thing. I loved that. And that was a California thing. That wasn't just L.A. thing or whatever, because I don't want to get confused. That was everywhere, Southern California. It was real. I mean, not every room did it, but most rooms did it. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, again, like I said, it's a function of just the reality. I mean, you're talking big, massive rooms. I mean, you could take a chip runner half an hour from the middle of the room to get to the cage and get your chips and come back, you know. I'm sure someone said, hey, well, let's just figure out a way here. We'll trust these trip runners with a bunch of chips to make it go faster. But interesting concept.
Yeah, very cool. I really liked that a lot. I mean, the rooms here aren't, in Florida or whatever, aren't as busy as that, so they don't really probably need that. But if they did, that would be the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
And one thing I noticed, too, is it's weird. We were pretty much a minority whenever we sat at the table. It's something I'm not used to having. I mean, it's just, it was different. I was definitely not in the majority, you know, a white male or whatever. It was definitely an odd feeling.
Mm-hmm. It's just different. I mean, nothing wrong with it, but
no,
it's different.
No, it was just different. I just never, I felt, I could see why people would make sure that English was spoken at the table, because really it was not the predominant language at the table.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And it was an interesting thing. I guess it's kind of similar to when you went to Punta Cana.
Yeah,
you know? And it was especially in LA. I mean, it happened in Southern California too to me when we were in Southern California. Every table I was at, I was still in the minority. So very interesting stuff.
I think one of the funnier things, too, I was playing at the casino, and the dealer chastised the player for speaking Vietnamese.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, I'm sorry, so English and computer play. And then the dealer started talking to her in Vietnamese, and they're laughing. So, I mean, they're able to remind you not to speak and then still have fun with it, too. But then I'm sitting around, hey, are they laughing about me, the fat white guy?
Exactly.
English only on the jokes, too, please.
Oh, my God.
All right, well, let's get into our little road trip here. We actually flew into San Diego, and we'll talk about San Diego in the next week. But and you'll hear about some of the crap-tastic cars we've had, too. But we got lucky. We got a nice little car this time. But certainly you're going to want to tune in the next week to find out why seeking the low rate it's not always the best thing in rental cars. But for this part of the trip, it was great. And then no sooner we lay on the ground, you're already whining.
Yes.
I just wasn't sure what it was going to be that you're going to whine about, but I know you're going to whine about something.
Oh, come on. You have to admit that you were disappointed. You know, your entire life, all you ever hear is about how perfect San Diego weather is. Oh, it's 83 year-round or 85. Whatever. It's always perfect weather. Always, you know, like we show up, it's cold, misting, and completely cloudy, overcast. I was like, what the hell is going on? I mean, I came all the way out here, 3,000 miles, stopped in Arizona on the way. I thought for sure we'd get to San Diego and you know, see the San Diego Zoo. It'd be beautiful, and the weather would be like, you know, it'd be like paradise. No, it was cold, and it was raining on me. Well, misting, which is even more annoying.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, it's not supposed to be perfect 100% of the time.
Well, I thought it was. I thought it was paradise. I'm sorry.
You need to go back to your geography teacher and say, hey. Well, you know, as overcast as it was, you had no problem seeing Legoland from the highway.
Just the sign. We didn't see the place.
We could drive by and go, Legoland! I thought you were going to make me pull over and buy you a big one of those big pinwheel suckers or something and relive your childhood. It's Legoland!
There's a huge sign that said Legoland. I was like, oh my God, it's Legoland! You know, but we could see the sign. It wasn't like it was fog. It was overcast, so it wasn't too hard seeing the Legoland sign. I was very excited about that.
Oh, man.
Even though I've never owned Legos, by the way.
You've never owned Legos?
Never owned Legos.
All right, so that explains why you're excited about Legoland, because you're coming out of repressed childhood.
Exactly. Okay, now I've admitted the secret. I didn't tell you on the trip, but here it is. I've never owned them. I've deprived as a child.
Now I'm going to have to get write an anti-up check for your therapy for the next week. Oh, terrific. Great. Looking forward to that. All right, well, we eventually made it to our first stop in L.A. was the Gardens, they call it now.
Yeah.
Used to be Hawaiian Gardens. And I like to say, where chips turn to green tea ice cream. And we didn't get green tea ice cream this time. I can't believe that.
No, it's because we didn't play.
No, but I mean, we had lunch there. We could have got green tea. Although mocha chip ice cream was a special.
Yeah, it was a special.
As much as I like the green tea ice cream at the Gardens, I would have been fine checking the mocha chip out. But we forgot. Fast and I talked about this on the show when we went out there before. I mean, it's really big tents, right?
Yeah.
And we were pulling up, you're like, wow, you guys are right. These are tents.
Yeah, they're two tents.
But a massive, massive tents, and a lot of games going on. And, the first thing they said when we met with folks, they're like, hey, this is a fun place to play.
Yeah.
We have friendly dealers here. We want you to have a good time. You got to go to these other rooms, and they're going to be a little stuffy. Here's where people come for fun. And you mentioned that right away. They have these big surfboards.
Yeah.
That show you the different games. And
it definitely seemed like a relaxed, atmosphere, and people were just there to have fun, and didn't seem very stressful. I mean, we didn't actually sit down and play with these people either, though. And that's one thing we need to make sure everybody understands. We didn't play in all the rooms.
Yeah, so they could have been totally like, Michael Douglas and falling down.
Yeah, we don't know. It could have been. He could have had his stick with him. But for the most part, yeah, it was cool. It was sort of laid back. It had these huge glow-in-the-dark surfboards with the area of the games. And, you could literally be like a mile away from one game to the other. So if you had your name on one board and you were near the room, these places are huge. So you got to get like a beeper or something. And the best part was the live parrot in the front.
Yeah. And listeners that stick to us for all four of these episodes are going to see a trend here as well, too. Not only was Chris denied Legos as kids, I think he was denied poultry as a kid. Because you were like sitting there talking to this parrot, having a conversation and stuff. And later on, part of the other trip, you were all over this bird and stuff. So, I know we flew to San Diego. Are you a big chicken fan or something? What's going on?
No, I had a parakeet when I was a kid, his name was Bucky, and he was cool.
Did you ever get a shoebox? I don't mean to bring.
No,
it up.
We had a nice little cage for him, and they used to change the gravel for him, and give him a little food. And he'd come out and he'd give you kisses and sit on your shoulder. So it was kind of cool. So when I saw the parrot, I was like, look at this. Look at this. They got a parrot over here.
Yeah. No, it was pretty cool.
It was.
I enjoyed watching. And the best part of you sitting there talking to the parrot is right next to it are the big racks and racks of the magazines. Which you find Ante up now, thankfully.
Yeah.
And it's right next to the crapper, right?
Yeah.
So these people, I was cracking up watching people walk by, pick one up, put it on their arms, and walk in, do their business.
Yeah. Yep.
So we know where our magazines can get read there. Because that's some serious thought there. All right, well, moving on from there to Hustler. And folks that remember the show from last time we were out there, I was really impressed with Hustler the last time I was out there. It hasn't changed now. I mean, you get this feeling, right or wrong, of what Hustler is, what the Hustler brand is.
Yeah.
And you kind of expect that it's going to be like that, and I'm not making any judgments. I mean, if you are a fan of Hustler, you're expecting it to be like that when you walk in. If you're not a fan of Hustler, you're probably expecting it to be like that. And for me, it was just very elegant.
Yeah,
and, absolutely.
Swanky.
Larry Flint. I know he likes to live the good life and have stuff, so it shouldn't be surprising to me. But yeah, it's very elegant, I think.
No, I know. It had beautiful chandeliers. It seemed to have that sort of velvet sort of, decor or whatever. It just seemed swanky. It seemed upscale and... It was nice. It was definitely a nice place. Not very big. And it was kind of in the round, I guess. Is that the way I would say it? It seemed kind of like the room was kind of curvature or whatever to it.
Yeah, it's like a big circle, it seemed like. They had like the high limit area like in the middle, I think, and then tables that rung around. And then they had a second room that was...
Yeah, in the back. It was like tournaments or something, yeah.
But yeah, it was an interesting rounded edge kind of design. And of course, you mentioned it, it's one of the smaller... rooms out there, so they don't run too many tournaments. They have three series a year, and they're in this Player of the Week promotion now, which is one of the cooler promotions we sell. But certainly one of the smaller rooms.
Yeah,
it's so big. Yeah. I mean, it's, I hate to say small, and people think it's like a four table room. It's not that at all. It's
oh yeah, no, it's, no.
When you're talking 180 table rooms across the city, it's not that.
Yeah, no. It was definitely a nice place to play in. I mean, it looked nice. It felt nice. And, again, that was one of the rooms where you just wish you had more time.
Yeah.
And you just didn't have enough time to play in all these rooms. But then we moved on to the Normandy, which is like right down the street, sort of, right? It was pretty close.
Yeah, really. It's pretty close. And I'm going to have to ask you here. I did not pick up on this Swiss chalet idea on the outside. Maybe I was busy on the BlackBerry or something, but go ahead and explain that to me.
I don't know. It just had the the chocolate brown pillars, you know, or the trusses or whatever, and it had the tan decor. It just, and it had the portico for the parking and everything. It just reminded me of some sort of, you know, Swiss Chalet, or, you know, or even the, if you remember, the Swiss Chalet hotel chain was kind of like that. It looked nice. It looked warm. It looked like if I walked in, there would be like a little fire going on in the fireplace. And I just, that's how I felt when I looked at it. And then when we got inside, it was really decorative, nice too. It had those huge golden plates in the ceiling and a massive brass bar where you could sit, you know, the brass fixtures and everything. And it was really pretty cool, you know. And a lot of new stuff's going to be coming out of this place soon too. Yeah, I mean, Tracy Edwards is a guy that's running it now. He used to run the bike and the Hustler. Mm-hmm. But he's trying to really build up this room now and get it on the same level as those, and I think he could do it. I mean, he's obviously been around a long time, but it did have this sort of dinner club feel, I have to admit. The brush, what I liked a lot too is the brush was right there when you walked in.
Yeah.
You know, you walk into a poker room or you walk into a casino, it takes you 6 hours to find the poker room sometimes.
Yeah.
This place, it's all card rooms, so you know, you walk in, boom. Brush is right there. Hey, can I help you? You're literally, the door is barely even closed behind you. And they're like, what game would you like to play today? What would you like? You know, and they're right on top of it. And that was kind of cool. I really appreciate not having to find the person that I need to get into a game.
That's an interesting discussion, too, because on this trip, I talked to another poker room manager, and he was telling me about some of the rooms that he liked. And he one he described he liked was one where the brush was inside the room, because he thinks it's important for you to have to walk inside the room and feel the action before you put your name on the list. And I think you and I are probably the different. Maybe we're just, you know, quick. I don't know.
I know what I want when I get there.
Want to get in and get out.
Yeah, so, exactly. I mean, I'm there for a reason.
we don't like to be, you know, herded around like going through the gift shop when you get off the roller coaster, you know, to get out kind of thing. But that's interesting.
When we go on these excursions, on these cruises, and when you get off the end of the ride, they manipulate you with all these misdirected signs to the exit, so they force you to go through all the trinkets and everything, and the salesman. I just want to go from the beeline. Like, geometry is my favorite subject. I know the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, and that's where I want. So when I come into a poker room, I want to get my chips and get my game, and that's exactly what I want. And when I went to Normandy, that's what I would have gotten, because they're right there. And that was really cool to me. I love that it's centrally located like that. Well, not centrally, but right at the front, in the middle of the card room.
And then the final thing, too, you mentioned that Tracy Edwards has been around a lot. I mean, I think one of the things that we saw in California throughout this trip was people have been in these rooms forever.
Yes.
Like, sometimes decades. And they don't look that old, either.
Yeah. So,
must be something about the nice weather out there.
The water.
But here's a guy that's just loves the area a lot. He was talking with us, and he's like, you know, hey, I could have gone a lot of other places, but I just love L.A. And so, you know, he's on his third, maybe even fourth casino out there now. I remember him talking about the bike and Hustler, but he might have worked somewhere else as well, too.
Right.
He just likes the area, so, you know, he's just moving from room to room and doing good things at it. So that's an interesting customer service standpoint thing, I think, too.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, it's funny, when we're back here, most of the people here and on this side, it's like turnover is remarkable. It's just like every other day we're, wow, did you know this guy left his job? No. Oh, my God, now we got to update our files. You know, we're always frustrated because we didn't know that somebody was leaving or getting fired or whatever. And out there, it's like everyone's been there 20 years. It's remarkable. But then we moved down to Hollywood Park, which I was really looking forward to because I knew Phyllis Carroll had run the room, was running the room. And even like our good friend Kenneth James, that's like some of his old stomping grounds, too. He actually got started playing in Hollywood Park. I know he likes to call the bike home, but Hollywood Park was a big place where he used to play a lot. So I was really interested in seeing it. I knew they had racing there, too.
Yep.
Which is one of the fewest, you know, that's like the only one in the area, right, that has racing on
site. Yeah, I think it's the only one, to be honest, in California that actually has racing, which is odd for us here in Florida, because like almost every room here has some kind of racing component to it.
Yeah, it's a prerequisite unless you're a tribal.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, so I thought that would be kind of cool, and the first thing they tell us is they're moving the poker room. They have a renovated area that's on the other side of the casino or whatever the building, and they showed us a little bit of that. But Phyllis Caro was really generous and really awesome with her time. And, you know, they're really hoping that, you know, condensing the room a little bit and moving it to a newer area with newer stuff would, you know, pretty much reinvigorate the action there. So they have a big event coming up, too, I think, in March, right? That's their signature event.
And what I think is funny about this is it's actually March to May.
To May, yeah.
Because it starts the last day of March and ends the first day of May. So it actually touches 3 months, but the entire month of April will be a big event out there. So
yeah.
And of course the new room's gonna be ready next month. So I'll have plenty of time to break it in before that event.
Yeah, so we didn't want to spend too much time on what the room was like because we knew they were going to move it and change it. So just be on the lookout for that if you're out there, and then we'll probably have something about it when it happens and then give you a little more details on it. So we didn't play there either, but I got the feeling that it was Hold'em there too from what I saw on the boards and stuff. So I really thought we were going to see a lot more mixed games than we did on this trip, and we didn't. So hopefully they are out there and we just happened to miss them when we were there.
All right, Chris, your job during all these road trip stories is to find synonyms for Big Kahuna. You probably read through the notes for the next couple of weeks, and I use this word like 90 times.
I'll look through it for you.
I'm not proud of it, but so I'm just letting you know right now I've got a problem, and you need to be there to fix it for me. So we went to the bicycle next, which is one of the Big Kahunas. had a great meeting there with the marketing director, who actually is one of the creators of Live at the Bike, which we didn't know.
Yeah, very interesting. That's true.
And she was proud that they have a major tournament there. I believe she said 8 of the 12 months a year.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. That's, oh my God, that's remarkable that you can do
massive
that.
Massive tournament house.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Huge floor, too. It was a huge, huge area. It reminded me of it's funny, a lot of these rooms remind me of, like, when Foxwoods first started, it wasn't what it is now, obviously. It was like this warehouse with tables. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean that it was like, if you had to have a warehouse where you display tables, you know what I mean? This is what it would be like. It'd be this massive building with just rows and rows and rows and rows of tables. Because really, what else are you going to do if you have to put this many tables in one spot? It's got to be this way, and it's just so massive. It's hard to comprehend when you see it.
Yeah.
It's so big, and Foxwoods was like that. It was like this huge one-story building with just tons and tons and tons of table games, and it was remarkable, and that's what this is like. It's just huge. If you've never, you know, if you come from a state where there's, you know, four tables in your poker room or eight or whatever, I mean, these people sneeze and eight tables fall out of their noses, okay? These places are massive. It's so big. And this is the first really, really big room we saw on the trip.
Absolutely. And more to the whole honesty nature of the LA poker market, they're like, you know, hey, our big weakness is we don't have a hotel here.
Yeah.
So when we have tournament players come in, we tell them to go stay at the Commerce.
Yeah.
And, of course, that hurts us because you're going to play the cash games where you stay because you can go up to your bed when you're done playing.
Yeah.
And but they're looking to change that. They're getting ready to build a hotel. Be 18 months before it opens. But be very interesting to see how that changes the dynamic.
Sure.
Out there.
Sure.
The hotel at that big, obviously runs probably the most tournaments of anywhere out there.
Yeah, and it changes the game in the sense that it becomes a destination now rather than someone else taking your, you know what I mean? Now you can say, all right, I'm going to end up at the Bike. I'm going to travel out there and stay at the Bike. And you know, it's a destination now more than just a stop by or a place that you're going to visit when you're staying somewhere else. So I can't wait for that to happen. See what happens. See, you know, because Commerce is really the only place to stay. And she was saying that. She's like, you guys staying at the Commerce, right? And we're like, yeah. She's like, no, that's okay. We know it. We know you're staying there. And it's definitely a game changer if they put up a decent hotel.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, then we made the short drive over to the Commerce, which is the
Big Kahuna.
Oh, I already used Big Kahuna once.
All right, well, I was going to say, you could say cheese.
You failed me.
You can say cheese. You can say wig, the big cheese. Big, I don't know.
big, wow, what am I in the 40s? I'm home.
It's 1800s England.
The big wig. All right, well, it's massive. Nearly 200 tables there. Though, to be honest, I mean, and the poker offerings are vast, so I don't want to diminish that. But our California game section is massive there.
Right.
So when you hear 200 tables, don't think that it's 200 Hold'em Stub Omaha tables. It's, I don't know really what the breakdown is, but a lot of people playing Baccarat, three-card poker, and Ultimate Texas Hold'em and things like that there.
Right, right. But it was still massive. And it was funny because as we got our tour of the place, he would, when he was walking from one end of the building to the other, he would tell us what year this part of the building was added on, you know, because it just kept growing and getting bigger. He's like, okay, now we're in 1984 Commerce, where this was it. This is only the only place where you could play poker. This is the only place to play any of the games. And then now we're in 1997, you know, or whatever it was. And you can see where we knocked down the wall here and then built the building here. And because the growth was just incredible. And then, of course, you can see where they added the hotel to the left. And it was pretty cool. And it just seemed like it was never ending. It's like, oh, back there's another room. Like, there's another room back there, and you just keep walking. It was huge.
Of course, you saw me saying, here's the low limit area. And we started giggling because we call it the kiddie pool.
Yeah. Minor leagues.
Yep. And then the bigger games, which actually started at 8/16 and higher, which I would expect even 8/16 to be in the kiddie pool. But that was a little. So I'm pretty close to getting out of the kiddie pool.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 years from now.
Yeah. I'm nowhere near that.
But those games are in the other room. But, you know, obviously they have some of the biggest tournaments in the area. And, everybody knows the Congress. So.
Yeah. I mean, even in the country, really. I mean, their LA Poker Classic is like the second largest tournament in the country behind the World Series. So they do it big, they do it right, and they have the hotel to back it up now. And that's probably another reason why the big games were in that area, because they were closer to the hotel.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, at the Crown Plaza, it was nice. I got to soak in the little hot tub at night there. I was the only one out there. I was the only one crazy enough to be out in the cold weather. the breezy weather, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah, it was breezy.
But, you know, it's a nice hotel. It's it's a good place to stay. And we were excited. We got to have dinner with our Los Angeles ambassador and longtime anti-upper, Dave Palm.
Yep.
He was one of the guys that came out to the original meetup at the Commerce years ago when we all paid $200 for appetizers. and just a great guy. We had a lot of fun talking to him.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun. And it's funny when we meet these ambassadors, you never know, like, how big or how small they are, because all you see is their head.
Picture, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like on TV. You have no idea how small Johnny Chan and Dan Negreanu really are. You think they're just normal-sized guys, and then when you run into them, they're like these, you know, hobbits, you know, instead of full-sized people. And you're like, oh, my God, they're so small.
Don't get Daniel twittering about you, man.
No, I'm just saying he's a lot smaller than you think, because he's a bit larger than life on TV. And the same with these guys, but the opposite. Like, when we met Dave, I was like, whoa. You're a big dude. I'm like, you're a lot bigger than I thought you were. You know, I didn't think you were this big. And he's like, yeah, I'm kind of tall. He plays volleyball, so that makes sense, you know. And great guy. Had a lot of fun with him. We had dinner with him in the sports bar there, in the sports restaurant, whatever. And we all exchanged our sports stories and poker stories. And he's just a good guy, and we're glad we got to meet him. And we met a couple other ambassadors too on the trip. So it was a lot of fun. But it was the first place we got to play, and it's kind of what we did was we visited as many rooms as we could, and the last room we were at for the day we'd play because it made sense. We were staying there or whatever. I was, like you said, disappointed. I didn't get to play the games that I wanted to play.
Well, this is what was funny, is because I built this up for you, and I felt bad that I built it up for you. And it wasn't disingenuous. I just didn't realize the market had changed so much. Well, we get in there, and all right, obviously you're disappointed there's nothing around. I'm like, oh, hey, there's a 4/8 stud game. That's what Chris is going to play. And you're like, I don't think so. I'm going to go play 3/6 limit. I'm like, what? Really?
I just wanted to get my feet wet.
Oh, my gosh. And I could tell, I could see you from where I was sitting, and I could just see the pain on your face.
Yeah, it was tough.
And I'm like, dude, get up and play 4/8 stud.
I know, and I should have done it right away. And you know, the funny thing is, the first three pots I won in 3/6, and they're all like, oh my god, you picked the right seat. And I got queens the first hand, ace queen the second hand, and I don't know what the third, king jack or something. But anyway, I won the first three pots, and I thought, oh my god, this is, I'm gonna crush this game. And then I proceeded to flop, you know, trips when a lady flops a boat, and then I make the nut flush and the board pairs on the river, and we've already capped it the whole way, and you know, that kind of thing. And I ended up like losing half my buy-in there, and I was like, you know what, I'm done with this. Let me go find No Limit Hold'em, win it all back. And of course I go No Limit Hold'em and lose my buy-in there, and I'm like, all right, let me go find the stud like I should have. And then so I did well in the stud. I think we've talked about that in the show, so I don't want to bore anybody, but they weren't really very good players, and they never gave you credit for any kind of hand. The first hand I sat down with, I had eight showing with an ace eight in the hole, and I paired my door card, and no one believed me, even though I bet double the amount. They just chased me the whole way, and when I ended up, I think it was just 3/8. I think I ended up with that, and the guy had two pair, and he thought he was good, and it was just no one believed you when you were playing. It was 4/8, man. You know, when it's 4/8 and you're betting the full amount on a paired, you know, door card, you think they would take you seriously, but they didn't. They did not care. And it was really – and like I said, I think at the end, I busted two guys on one hand, and it ended up making it like four-handed, and the game broke. I was like, I'm not playing four-handed. And they all left. I was like, damn it, because I was making a lot of money. I ended up winning all my money back on that table, and I was kind of ticked off. So then it was like all I had left to do was sit around and wait for another 4-8 seat to open up or play No Limit Hold'em or go to bed. So I went to bed.
I enjoyed playing my 4-8, and I think I talked about my first pocket forehand last week where the guy mucked his hand when he would have easily beat me. But pocket fours were great for me on this trip because I had one hand that I'll talk about before we move on to the hand of the week. But I had pocket fours again, and it's one of these things in the limit I hate. You start playing, and I was doing all right, so then you get a little bit loose than you should be. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, pocket fours, I'll come in and play this. And then it got raised and re-raised and capped, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just put $16 in on pocket fours against like 27 people. I mean, there's no way I'm going to win this unless I flop a set. And of course the flop comes ace-ace-four, and I'm like, and I giggle to myself, and at the same time I slap myself because I know that I have them beat right now, but the next two cards I'm going to have to sweat pretty badly.
Yeah.
If somebody has ace-king and it comes a king or a queen or jack or anything like that, I'm dead. So, you know, I kept jamming all the way. On the river, there's a third guy that stayed in all the way to the end. He was just calling our other raises. And the river, he bets right into us. And I'm like, oh, man, he caught his kicker. So I just called, and the other guy just called. And that guy that bet out was ecstatic. He turned to his heart, flush! And I just started giggling. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe you're staying in this for a flush with all this raising. And, of course, the other guy had ace-king and mucked, and I dragged this massive pot.
Jeez.
Just kind of set the tone for the whole trip. But just kind of funny. I really miss playing 4-8 limit against players like this. I wish I could get it around here.
Yeah, I know. I know. I would have loved for that 4-8 stud game to be a stud 8 game.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, and I was disappointed. But I think that maybe – I think the stuff is out there. We just didn't hit it right or whatever.
Yeah,
so.
It was a busy trip.
Busy trip, so.
Got to spend a lot of time, but – all right, well, tune in next week when we continue our trip through Southern California, all the rooms San Bernardino down to San Diego, and we'll have a lot more fun.
This is Noah Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
Okay, so this clearly is one of those situation hands, right? Not hand of the week. And just to remind our listeners that we're an hour 40 into the show already, so... hopefully we'll get through this pretty quickly and not have you guys fall asleep on us.
Yeah. All right, so two quick situations here that came in. Remember, you can send your actual hands of the week or your situations to podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and we'll send you a lovely piece of swag like a T-shirt from PMS Pokerwear, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up store at antiupstore.com. Our two situations come from folks that are very well swaggish already. So the first one comes from Riley Crawford. And he had an interesting situation arise the last time he was at the casino, Chris, which is good because we hate when people send us in their boring situations.
Yeah, who cares about that?
took place at Montego Bay Casino, where our poker room Antiup cruise manager, Jody Russell, used to work.
Yep.
I've been waiting for a seat to open up. Just ended up opening a table. At the beginning, there were just seven players. The first hand of the night went like this. Under the gun folds. Under the gun plus one does a standard 6x.
6x raise?
Yep, 6x raised
to $12. Okay.
This is one to crappy no limit hold'em table.
Okay.
6x is the standard raise for this card room, he says.
Okay.
Under the gun plus two calls, and I look down at ace of clubs, queen of clubs, and I had the biggest stack at the table with $500, which was the max buy-in. First hand of the night, I decided to fold, as does everyone else behind me. I wanted to dip my toe in the proverbial pool before I began splashing around in the pond. I would have flopped three queens, turned a full house, and two players checked it all the way down. Under the gun plus one turns over king-jack suited. Under the gun plus two wins the pot with 10-10. Was this too tight a fold on my part?
Yes. Yes. You have
without
a suited
hesitation.
A first hand at a brand new table where no one has a bigger stack than you. You have suited ace-queen probably in position against the guys who raised and called. and you don't call for $12 when you have $500 in front of you. So, I mean, yeah, don't go broke with a queen in your hand, but it's the first hand, so you don't know how they play anyway. So ace-queen's way better than average, and you're in position. If anything, I might have even re-raised with that hand, but probably just called. But yes, yes, it was too tight. Way too tight. Got to call with that hand and see what happens. You got 40% of a royal flush.
All right, I agree I would have called, but I don't think it's worth piling on. I mean, first hand, I mean, I'm big on this. I think we talked about this on that crazy hand at the tournament I had a couple weeks ago. I really want to get a sense for how the table plays before I get involved in a hand. And ace-queen is one of those hands that really is strong here, suited, obviously, too. And it could be big, but it's a hand that gets you into trouble.
Yeah, I know.
So I'm not going to knock him for folding. But you had two people. If it's a standard race of 12 bucks, that doesn't really say too much to me. And you got a caller. Now you got a pretty decent pot there. You know, you could flop a couple clubs. You could flop two queens, three queens, like you said. I'm going to take with $500 in front of me, I'm going to take a $12 flyer here.
And the other thing, too, is I don't know. He said it's standard, but if it's his first hand, how do you know that's standard unless
he brought place in the room off.
That's what I'm saying, unless that's what the room normally does. And if that's what the room normally does, then you can tell these guys have been there a while, and they're probably playing like every other player that plays there. So go on your own general knowledge of the room and take a flyer with ace-queen suited. Yeah, and I'm not piling on him either. I definitely would have called there.
Interesting to me too was under the gun plus one raised with king jack suited.
Yes,
and then under gun plus two didn't raise with pocket tens.
Well, they're just tens, so I agree with the call. See what the board is, and then judge. So just tens, but the ace queen I would have called with.
All right, Riley, you messed up. All right, our second situation of the week comes from Father Paul. He has been on the show in 2 weeks. I feel bad. And he said he had a winning session last night, which, of course, this was probably 7 months ago.
Right.
So, hope you're still winning, Father Paul. But one hand, I'm not sure I played right. I'm sure Chris will tell you you're right. pocket tens on the button. There are only tens! See, I was doing the match game reference there.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Tying the shows together. Pretty smart. Pocket tens on the button. Four callers to me. I raise. Everyone calls. Ace, queen, six on the flop. Ugh. Checked around to me, though, and I bet threefold, leaving me heads up against a guy I don't have much of a read on. Turn is a blank. He checks. I check. River's another blank. He checks, as do I, and he has jack-jack. Is this a clear misplay here, or do you think I bet on the turn?
Yeah, I don't know. The problem is I don't know how much he raised to get all those callers. Maybe he misplays it there first.
That's a good point.
I can see following through with a bet on that flop to represent the ace and the queen. But the problem is, if you're checking the turn, you're telling him you don't have an ace or a queen. That's the problem. By betting, you're telling them you do have it. I would think that you should bet again there, only because you're trying to say, I have it. I understand that you're afraid of this guy, but he's checked you. You're in position. If he's going to do a check raise, he's probably doing it on the flop, probably not the turn. So when he checks to you, he's got to be telling you that he's not happy with his holding, and you bet. If he calls, it means that he wants to not float you because it can't really float. He's not in position, but he's trying to see if you're really serious. That's when you need to bet again on the turn, because I felt like the whole point, you didn't have the ace and the queen, so why are you betting? You're betting to represent it. So now if you represent it, you're telling him you have it. If you had it, you wouldn't have checked the turn. So I think that I would bet the turn in this situation, the way he played it.
This is obvious, Chris.
Is it obvious? Sorry.
Obviously, I mean, it's not at all obvious. I think there's. This is a difficult situation. I mean, one of the things, one of the leaks of my game that Lee Childs plugged for me is reminding me that I don't need to bet this turn, even if I had an ace or a queen.
Right.
You know, keep the pot small and. You know, then you can spring back in action on the river. And I like that a lot. So, I mean, we took a stab and folded around on the flop. You know, maybe we can bet and represent the ace and everybody folds. Well, we got a caller. Okay, he probably has an ace or a queen. I mean, he didn't put any suits on here, so I'm assuming that there wasn't a flush. So at that point, you got to think you're beat. So I don't think there's anything wrong then with checking the turn. But when he checks the river then...
That's the thing.
I think he's opening it up to me to make a bet at that point just to say, hey, all right, I have a weak ace. I You made me think that you had a better ace than me, but then you checked the river. Why would you do that? I think I got you beat. I'm going to put a bet in. And probably could have got this guy to fold, maybe.
Yeah. I think you have to be willing to bet the river if you're going to check the turn.
Yeah, you got to bet one or the other.
Right.
And I could also defend betting the
turn, checking the river.
Too, because, you know, let's say the guy raises you. Well, at that point, you can get away from this hand pretty easily, I think.
Yeah.
You know, because really, I mean, again, we don't know the suits here, really. So, but I mean, really, what is somebody raising you with here if they don't have you beat?
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
And then you can get away from that rather than, you know, potentially putting out a bigger bet on the river and getting raised there and feeling like you have to call because it's a river, blah blah blah. So I mean, you're going to get your information there. So I'm not sure really where it matters for you bet, but I think you needed to bet somewhere. That was a mistake, is not betting.
Yes.
All.
Yeah. The two checks in a row. It's like, okay, the only thing now is you can hope he has nines. Because other than that, you know you're beat. So if you know you're beat and you can't win, then why aren't you betting at least to try to take it down somewhere? Because you represented the ace or the queen. So I agree. It has to be a bet. I would bet the turn, but if he checks the river, you have to bet the river then.
Excellent. So two situations down in record time there, Chris.
That was very good. Very good. It took less than 10 minutes.
All right, folks. We'll come back next week. We'll tell you about Southern California. Sunny Southern California. It was sunny later on in the day. Or the next day. So.
Yeah, because it wasn't San Diego.
First, make you think it's like London, where it's always rainy.
Yeah, well, it wasn't San Diego. We were in different parts of the state after that. So.
Oh, yeah, but we eventually got back to San Diego. Nice.
Do you recall what the weather was like when we got back to San Diego?
I do not. I just know it was fine.
Okay. All right. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.